Plan That Trip is a diabolical, jovial, and festive journey where outdoorsy friends plan crazy trips in the moment. Occasionally, we find something, or in this case, someone, so unbelievable that we have to follow up. In our previous episode on the topic of volcanoes, we mention a man named Christoph Tuscher. You'll be hearing from him today. He'll be properly introduced in a few moments, but just so you know, this episode is about a man who was born in Switzerland, now lives in Portland, Oregon, became a computer engineer, has authored 4 books, has a PhD, and after achieving all of that, decided to become an ultra runner. That's someone who does ultra marathons or races of sometimes 100 miles or longer. This show is special because it is a fascinating interview with a very above average human, but we'll be back to our normal Plan That Trip format next week. Enjoy the show! Well, this is Plan That Trip. My name is Josh. Here we have Emily in Cleveland, Ohio, but all the way on the other side of the country, we have Dr. Christoph Tuscher. How are you doing today?
Excellent. How about you folks?
Oh, we're doing, it's probably, well, it might be colder here. I don't know. What's the temperature at in Portland?
It's pretty cold. Yeah. It's just above freezing actually. Yeah. Rainy. Oh, yeah.
So colder. That's about right. In Cleveland, we have a constant state of gray and rain. So I know that we share that in the wintertime. So I wanted to introduce Christoph really quick to our listeners. We're interviewing Christoph because we were doing a podcast about the trip from Mount Adams to Mount St. Helens. And we came upon this idea when we were doing a volcanoes podcast. So going from one unexploded volcano to one that recently exploded. And the right. idea was to backpack all the way from Mount Adams to Mount St. Helens, which looked like a phenomenal feat. And here we are. The only thing we could find on the internet when we searched this adventure was your run from one to the other, which I knew that there was someone out there, someone who had the crazy idea of doing that. What spurred the idea of even trying something as crazy as that?
It's kind of a funny story. It was, I think, sometime in the summer. Well, just actually, yeah, summer 2014, when I was climbing Mount Adams with a friend, and we were coming down, and she goes like, "Well, Christoph, now you could just run to St. Helens and climb St. Helens as well." And I go like, "Well, that's completely insane. I don't think you can do that." And so as I got home, I was like getting out the map and was like thinking, well, could this possibly be done? And I started like, is there a route and whatnot? And actually there's what's called the Boundary Trail that pretty much connects Mount Adams and St. Helens. And so as I was like looking at that route, I go like, well, maybe this is a plan for next year. But it turns out there was like a weather window, and I just went the same year and pulled it off. And it was one of my first really big adventures. I was absolutely clueless before that.
So what year did you attempt this?
It was 2014, and I started running in 2013. So it was really my very first year of like running. I was a beginner.
So I came across this video. It was the Oregon Desert Trail. They interviewed you. And on this, it blew my mind to know that in the early 2010s was the first time that you started ultra running, and that this adventure came shortly after that. Was it a wake-up call, or was it something that immediately inspired you? Was the pain something that you just like had in your soul and you were totally into, or was it something that you had to accustom yourself to?
No, it was very gradual. I mean, it's like running. It's very incremental. You start somewhere, you do a 5K, you do a 10K, and then you just keep going. And I had this goal when I started, and I think it was March 2013, that I would do a 100-miler within a first year. And I managed to do that. And then from there, it was like, oh, now I can't stop. Now I have all this, you know, fitness and level of endurance that I can just like build on top of that. So I started doing more and more extreme adventures. And so it's just like continued. I never really stopped from there.
So this is a good point to go back a little bit and investigate the person that becomes an ultra runner. Just among the accolades that I wrote down in my notes to talk about you is that you have 4 books to your name, including 2 biographies or books that are related to Alan Turing, many scientific papers that I was able to uncover. You're a fastest known time chaser in that a lot of the trails that you go for, you're going for the FKT, as it's called it. The Oregon Desert Trail, you did a through hike or run in 17 days, 15 hours. That's 750 miles in 7 days and 15 hours, or an average of 43 miles per day. And then, and this blew my mind, 1 week later, you did the Steen's Rim Run Trail and finished 4th in the race. So, you know, obviously let up a little bit there. And then finally, one of the best things to your name is the fastest known time, Washington section of the Pacific Crest Trail, 10 days, 1 hour, 26 minutes. I guess my question is, fastest known times are a big thing now. Do you know if those records stand up? Have people been following and trying to break those ever since you set those?
Yeah. They did. Somebody took the Pacific Crest Trail FKT away this year, actually, and he was like more than a day faster, so he really crushed my time.
Wow.
Which is incredible. And I think he had much worse weather than I did, so I'm not fast. I'm too old to be really fast, but I can persist and go long, and I think my sort of niche is more the crazy adventures that also need a lot of preparation and logistics. And And so that's the thing where other people, I guess, don't have the time, or maybe don't have the desire to invest time into, you know, lots of planning and logistics and whatnot. And perhaps one example is that Eagles 33 challenge that I completed this year. It took me 2 years to climb all 33 peaks over 4,000 feet in the Eagle Mountains and in eastern Oregon. And you know, it was very complicated to find a good route and whatnot. So it was just a huge investment. And I think many are not willing to sort of do that.
So would you say trip planning is one of your favorite elements of it?
I do like, you know, the whole package, right? From the idea to like finding your route, mapping out things, and then, you know, do a couple of practice runs and really train hard for that specific environment. And that includes, you know, nutrition, what you pack, the gear and everything. And so many of these things boil down to, you know, the stars kind of have to align with everything, not just your endurance, right? You have to be ready in every aspect, and route finding could be challenging. Again, the food could be challenging, and having, you know, the right amount of calories and all of these things. So it's just a very much all around challenge that I like personally. Yeah.
So I'm a thru-hiker myself, and my go-to was Snickers bars on the Appalachian Trail. What is your source of calories most of the time?
Actually, also Snickers bars.
All right.
Yeah. No, they're really good. And I do a lot of gels as well, but for long distance, you can't really do that. So then I do like dehydrated stuff and, you know, prepare my own little Ziplocs and whatnot. So these are all things I learned over the last couple of years. How much do you need, right? What's the sort of things you'll crave and whatnot? And again, back to that Adams to St. Helens adventure, I was absolutely clueless. I was looking at my nutrition that I packed, like 4 waffles and a couple of gels. I mean, that's like, what did I think, right? This is never going to be enough. Of course, now I would like do things totally differently.
So this is a question that gravitates around our staff at times. Do you ever decide what version of yourself you're going to be that day when you wake up? Do you plan well ahead of time that I'm going to be the Christoph that is the 100-mile racer, or the person who is writing a scientific paper that day, or perhaps penning a new book?
Not really in that sense, no, but I think a lot boils down to troubleshooting. Right, nothing is going to go according to plan, at least for most of these big things. It's just not going to happen the way you think it will happen. So I think being successful boils down to troubleshoot and improvise and, you know, find the way to still finish the whole thing, even though you may be suffering or running out of food or have to modify the route, whatever it is, right? It's about those things. And And I think people who do that successfully, that's the ones who finish, not necessarily the fastest, but they finish.
Now, you seem really comfortable around mountains, and it seems that whenever you do these runs, you're always orienting them. I mean, with the possible exception of the desert trail, which still does have some peaks. Did you grow up around mountains? Were you familiar with them from a young age?
Yeah, I grew up in Switzerland, so right in the Swiss Alps in the middle. And so, yes, it's certainly something I'm quite familiar with. And maybe that's the reason why I enjoy these things. But I really also enjoy the deserts and, you know, the sort of like endless flat landscapes where you have totally different challenges. So to me, that's very fascinating as well.
So in a lot of your videos, you are always talking about in joke form, and the comedy is hilarious in your videos, I have to mention. So if you have the chance to check off Christoph's YouTube channel, you'll find a lot more comedy than you expect.
Thank you.
If you were to say, what is the big reason why that you try any of these ventures, that you decided to get into ultra running? It's certainly a different type of mentality than your average hiker or those that are going out for a day and doing something perhaps emotionally or physically intense, but getting to sleep in a bed at the end of the night. What is the big why behind all of this? Why did you decide that was the thing you wanted to do?
I guess it's just part of me, right? It's a challenge and it's pushing boundaries and limits. And that's perhaps also the biggest overlap with my job, with research, where we also push boundaries and we try to find new exciting things. And ultra running, I think, is very similar in that sense. And you also have to deal with failure a lot. And most of the things you try don't actually work, right? That's sort of like, that's just part of the deal. And I find that fascinating to see how far you can go, how long you can go, what do you need, and sort of like pushing the limits of your own body. That's very similar to pushing the limits of a computer and find better ways how we can solve problems and whatnot. So there's both. And there's perhaps also a bit of a, you know, whenever I teach, you're expected to be a role model in some sense. And I think this is a good way for me to show that I'm really going deep outside of my comfort zone. And if I tell students they should do that and I do it myself, it becomes much more credible, I think.
So you mentioned that computers are your thing. You're actually talking to a couple people that are also really into computers. Emily, not to put the words in your mouth, but is really into video games. I mean, I'll let you speak to that.
I mean, I'm a software developer and I'd like to get into game development and kind of working on some smallish indie games for myself right now.
And I would consider one of my biggest influences in the outdoors is adventure and playing, you know, I guess a lot of kids are coming up in video games and computers nowadays, but I just spent the last week or so putting together a couple new laptops to get ready for all of my recording software and stuff. So we're computer people too. And I'm wondering, where is that gap? What took you, like, what is so interesting to you about computers? And I guess you explained this a little bit, but what is so interesting to you about computers that you could also relate to ultra running? Is it just figuring out problems, planning trips or planning routes?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But what I also very much like about the research part and the ultra running part is the sort of optimizing problems and finding the best solution you can possibly find. Right. If you're a good coder and you're looking for an algorithm that is efficient, you're spending a lot of time potentially optimizing, right? How could you do this, whatever sorting problem or whatever, right? It is, you want to solve it efficiently. And ultra running is very similar, right? If you want to get an FKT and be the fastest, well, that means you have to optimize everything you can possibly optimize. So I think that challenge is, at least to me, feels very, very similar. There's also the sort of unpredictability, I guess, right? Many computers don't exactly do what you want them to do. If you, at least if you're a coder, right? Just debugging is like a big part of your job. And that's back to the problem solving and improvising if you're doing like a big FKT. And you just have to have that same mindset in many ways, I think.
So the common vein that goes through all of your videos is that something goes wrong and that it doesn't always end up exactly the way that you expect it to. I know there's a moment, I call it the zombie state, when you get to a point at the end of your day or when your energy just leaves you and you're just putting foot in front of foot, that you are making mistake, you are falling down. Is there ever a moment that you decided that you were going to quit, or was there a moment that you thought you would and you pushed through it that was really important to you in becoming an ultra runner?
Yeah, there's both, definitely. I mean, there's, I mean, you mentioned that or asked whether I'm like in the morning sort of get up and want to become a specific person or, you know, like, okay, today I'm going to be successful. In my experience, that's not how it works, at least for me, right? Sometimes I think, well, this is going to be the perfect day, right? I go out and start and I realize, no, this is just not working. And I have plenty of examples where I quit and then was like, okay, this is really not the day. I'm not ready, or the conditions are not right. And you don't want to die, obviously, in these things. So you sometimes really have to pull the plug. And I think that's another skill that you have to have. So, you know, that's one aspect of, making good decisions. And I think that is very much important in this whole ultra running thing. Yeah.
So what does that training look like when you go out? Do you run 100 miles every day, or is it that you do 10 miles? And what's the elevation look like?
It varies a lot what cycle I'm going through and what I'm training for. For the PCT, very specifically, I was training as much as I could on the PCT to really get used to the, you know, trail surface and whatnot. And for that 33 Peaks challenge, that was all off trail. So I trained very differently because the elevation gain was really the key factor there. And it was a lot of scrambling. So that means I'm shaping my training as much as I can to replicate the situation I think I'll have on the actual attempt. And so, yeah, again, for deserts is another example, right? If you have to go with little water and you have to be used to heat, well, then I train in the heat. And an elevation gain is certainly something I train quite a bit for, also because I'm not, as I said, I'm not really fast, but I can be very persistent with going up and down and up and down. And that's perhaps one of my strengths, I think.
So we're a bunch of flatlanders here, but I guess that's one thing that like Oregon has in common is that you've got these giant mountains, but you know, where you're sitting in Portland, you're pretty close to sea level. You know, more or less that you're sitting in the soup of oxygen rich air. But a lot of the things that I've seen you doing, you're going up into mountains that that can really take away from that. So say, and this is a true thing, I wanted to become an ultra runner in this area of Cleveland, Ohio, where I have absolutely no access to elevation. What should I do to try to train myself for that first mountain that you're not only dealing with crazy uphill slope, you're also dealing with, altitude?
Yeah. Well, that's a big problem. If you're living at sea level, I mean, I think what I hear from most people who live in the flatlands is like they're using a stadium stair or a Stairmaster or something that, you know, is going to just be mind numbing and you just go up and down and up and down. Acclimatizing for altitude, that's a whole other story. And it takes time, but if you go up quickly and go down quickly, you can usually deal with it. If it's not, you know, 18,000 feet or more, you may get headaches and whatnot, but it's not like you can't do it. It's just maybe a little bit more painful and you may suffer a bit more and then you may not be working at your full potential as if you would, you know, for 2 weeks live up at the base of Mount Hood and really get acclimatized. But there is not much that you can do except if you have one of those altitude tents and you sleep in them at night. But even that is quite controversial and it's questionable whether it actually does much to your red blood cells in terms of keeping them, at least, because if it's just at night, then you're going to lose a lot during the day again. So I don't think there's a real secret. You really have to be at altitude and do the traditional acclimatizing if you want to go really, really high.
So that was a highly scientific answer. So it begs my next question. you've written two or penned two books that have to do with Alan Turing. And I'm curious is that an inspiration to you? Did he have some sort of, could you relate his ingenious mind to what you're trying to do, either with computers or in ultra running? Was that an inspiration to you?
To some extent, yeah. It turns out he was actually a really good runner. He was almost Olympic level. I think he actually qualified 1 year, and he had this thing that he would sometimes run for hours from Bletchley Park, where he was working during the Second World War. He would run to London for meetings, and he would get there like in his sweaty clothes, and he would run for hours to get to his meetings. And so he was quite a crazy guy in many ways, and certainly a brilliant mind. And yes, I think he definitely was an inspiration and still is an inspiration, both, you know, athletic wise, but also computing wise, right? He really is the father of modern computer science in so many ways.
So a lot of my experience with Alan Turing, I, like most of the world, I suppose, comes from the movie that was released with starring Benedict Cumberbatch. Yeah. And I have to say, his life was fraught with a lot of uncertainty and doubt. And did you ever experience any of that when pursuing your degrees, when deciding that in the early 2010s that you're going to start up ultra running? I'm curious what is inside of you that allows you to not only get a 2 degrees and teach classes, write books, but then also do ultra running. You seem to be made of some stuff that I can't even claim to be made of myself. And I'm curious, like, where does that come from? Was it a parent figure? Was it the way that you're brought up?
I don't know. I don't have a good answer to that. I think I tend to say it's just me, right? It's my personality. And I do like challenges. I do like, you know, to think about new things differently and tackle problems in new ways. And so that's kind of like, you know, it keeps things exciting. And I think one other aspect is that I get bored pretty quickly with things. So I'm always looking for the next thing. And can I do things better? Can I do things differently just to keep myself busy? And in my classes, for example, I enjoy reading new things just because I get bored with the old book that I've been reading maybe for two years, right? Then I just force myself to do something new. And so that, I think, contributes to, you know, doing these adventures. And there's always something new, right? People always ask me, well, what's going to be next? And, well, I don't know, right? I have a long list of things I could possibly do. And then I get excited about something, or I get really obsessed actually with something. And I just, you know, work on it for a long time. And sometimes I realize, well, it's not working and it's got to be next year or whatever it is, right? There, it's not like I have a master plan by any means. I think I'm much more opportunistic in actually both ultra running and, you know, professional things. I like new opportunities and new things.
Has COVID-19 contributed, well, I guess taken away is the question I should ask, from any adventures or opportunities that you were seeking? Has it changed your training? Has it changed any opportunities to get out and chase some FKTs?
Yeah, I think it did. Yeah, I mean, the training is different. I'm not running in the same spots as much as I did. And you can't really run with other folks. And so, it definitely changed things. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we're in Cleveland, Ohio, and that's the home of the Cleveland Browns. So we're incredibly familiar with defeat. And we're incredibly familiar with not quite making it through. Was there ever a moment that you did have to call it quits in the middle of a run? Was there ever a moment that you saw a challenge and you rightfully knew that it was too much for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Oregon Desert Trail, I had to try twice. The first time I got injured at, I don't know what it was, like 300 miles or something. And I really couldn't continue. That was a huge setback. And I knew I could do it again the same year. I had to go back and replenish all the caches. And so it was a huge logistical setback in every way. Mm.
So how did that happen exactly? How did your injury come about on the Desert Trail?
So I think I was not well prepared for the surface, right? I was mentioning earlier, it's, you want to prepare for the trail or the surface that you're actually going to run on. And I totally underestimated, I think, the amount of soft ground. So it was just the heavy pack plus the soft ground that really got to my Achilles. And I didn't train appropriately for that sort of like load for that long of a time. And then things just, you know, got worse and worse until I basically couldn't walk anymore. And I mean, there was no, I didn't have a choice. I just couldn't continue physically, right? It was just not the thing. And I, you know, it happened in other adventures for sure as well. Maybe not with injuries that much, but sometimes you get lost or you just, you know, see no way you can ever finish within the amount of food you have and whatnot. So I think it happens plenty of time and people don't realize it, right? Mostly I put out these videos of like successful things, or there's a report for something you've achieved, but I may have done six attempts or more before and I failed plenty of times. And I do make an effort to also, you know, put that out there because I think people realize then that, well, nothing is perfect, right? You really have to work hard for some of these things. And I think some people struggle with that they want to, you know, go out and do it the first time and be successful. And otherwise it's not a success. But no, if you fail, you learn a lot of things and right. I mean, again, Adams to St. Helens was my very first thing, which, you know, sort of like was really a learning experience for me. The first one where I realized that I got pretty much everything wrong. So you build on top of that and you get better. And the next time you pack more food and you plan differently. And
yeah, let's drill into that then. So Mount Adams, it seems like a pretty stiff climb. And it looked like in your video that you started basically at night. It wasn't even that day yet. It was it must have been like midnight or so for your alpine mm-hmm. start. And you got up to the top of that mountain and it was still dark. Was that mm-hmm. challenging for you to be able to go up and then scale back down with darkness all around you?
Yeah, it is. I've climbed it many times before and most people climb it in 2 or 3 days and they, you know, they camp up halfway up. And so it's challenging if you don't know what you're doing, but if you have a GPS track and you know the route, it's totally manageable. And I was very comfortable with that at night. It was more like I didn't want to run that section I didn't know at all during the night. So it was like just shifting things around so that I could run the best or the section that I was the most unfamiliar with during the day. But the nights are challenging. Yeah. Always. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I personally when I'm doing through hiking or any sort of long distance hike, I have a no hiking at night policy if it can be strictly avoided. Okay. Because I feel as if all of the scariest, worst thoughts that you've ever had come out when you're in the middle of the forest at night. And it's so beautiful and so amazing until you're surrounded by this pressing darkness. what was the hardest thing for you about that run section? It seemed like that had to have been absolutely crazy. We dove in a little bit into that area and it really didn't seem like there was any area of respite all the way between those. It seemed like there were some roads, of course, for possible bailout options, but other than that it seemed like there was a lot of challenging terrain.
Yeah, it's fairly challenging. I think that it was a lot of pressure on me because I was way too slow than what I expected. And you know, that's a traditional area. You do a couple of races and you think, oh, that's my pace now, let me predict what this like 90 mile adventure will take, right? And you sort of assume race pace, and race pace obviously is like, well, you're really fast, you have aid stations and there's other people that motivate you to go fast, right? If you do it something alone, you have a heavy pack, there's nobody around, there's no aid station, you have to filter your water, it just takes way more time. So my estimate for how fast I was going to be was like way off, like hours off, right? And so the longer I was getting into the whole run, the further back I fell into my planning. And then I was thinking about, you know, the folks who were waiting for me, my wife and the friend, who were like, we had a plan that after at a certain cutoff time, they would like, you know, come and actually search for me. And I was getting, you know, really, not panicking yet, but I was, you know, getting to that sort of like threshold where I was like, okay, this is just going to fall apart because I won't make it in time and I won't have enough food. And so then you're starting all this sort of negative feedback, right? I'm too slow, I can't go faster, so what? And then I want to quit. it's not a good cycle, but luckily things worked out, right? But I think that was a big learning lesson for me, that you have to have a really, really solid plan, especially if you have a crew that waits for you somewhere. You have to be able to communicate, and things need to be very robust against, you know, big big changes in your plans, basically.
Right. And you mentioned your crew and your wife. How in the heck do they feel about all of this? I guess that emotion needs to be taken into account as well. All of the people that love you, how do they feel about these adventures of yours?
I know. Yeah. You know, that's the thing, is they mostly don't know before what they're really getting into. And then there's like afterwards, there's discussion and about like, okay, the next time I'm not going to do this again. So I've heard that many times now. No, but this is also good, you know, for me to know, sort of like, okay, how do I make their life much more pleasant? With planning and, you know, spreadsheets that I can give them and say, hey, this is sort of like the scenarios. If this happens, do this. If that happens, do that. Right. We didn't have those sorts of plans. It was like making things up as we went. And luckily, there was no, you know, major disaster, but it could have been a disaster.
Have you ever had a plan that you were talked out of, what you talked yourself out of, or someone else talked you out of before you even tried it?
No, not others usually, but myself, yes. I'm really big into spreadsheets, and I like, you know, coming up with scenarios and whatnot. And often I have like three scenarios, sort of the worst case, the best case, and what's realistic. And you know, I can spend hours tweaking numbers and figuring out what may work and what may not. But almost always I get it wrong, even though I spend so much time on things. And so, it's interesting.
There was a quote that you had in the video I saw with the Oregon Desert Trail Association. That said, you said, I put things in place so it would be hard for me to quit. And I don't know why it was about that quote, but it's simultaneously spoke literally to things that you were putting in places so that you could continue your trip. And that you do some stashes, I think, correct, in both like desert trails and mountain trails, so that you can have gear waiting for you. But then also, what are the things that you put in place that makes it difficult for you to give up? Like, is it a mental thing? Are there physical things that you remind yourself of so that you can keep going?
Yeah, I think what I referred to with that was that I really didn't want to take a cell phone with me. And I'm pretty strict with that, actually, on most of my adventures, because if you have a phone, it's easy. Well, assuming you have reception at all, it's much easier to make a call or send a text and say, hey, I'm done. If you don't have that capability, the barrier is somewhat higher. And also knowing that, especially for the Oregon Desert Trail, that if somebody has to come and pick me up, we're talking 8, 9, 10 more hours of driving in the middle of nowhere, sometimes, you know, really sketchy roads. So if I quit, that means a lot of people are going to be inconvenienced, and it's a big deal just to come and get me somewhere. So again, that's setting the bar high, right? If you're sort of like, you get to these points where you can hop on a bus or take a train or hitch a ride, then it becomes easier for you to quit. And I think that's exactly what I want to avoid by design, by not having a phone, not having these opportunities as much as possible, so that you don't even get into that mindset of, oh, I could quit. All right, it will be easy. I could drive home. And you don't want to be in that situation, basically. So it's more like, you know, avoiding that sort of mindset and not getting into that quitting mode.
So the Cleveland Outpost services a lot of beginners, and I think a lot of people will take a lot of what you are saying as inspiration to maybe start up running or ultra running. Mm-hmm. What would you say to that absolute beginner, someone who has a little bit of running experience but has just sees ultra running as something that's cool and they want to try it? What would you tell them to try to get in the ultra runner mode or shape from just being a casual runner?
Yeah, there's different things. I think one is to see really the absolute amazing aspects of being able to go really far and get into wildernesses or places that you would typically need several days to hike in. I can run that in a day and, you know, have the same experience. So that, I think, is amazing, and people should realize that. They often tell me, oh, but you're running, so you can't really see everything, and, you know, you're going too fast. I don't think that's the case, right? It's amazing how much more you can see by going the distance. So, you know, that's the good part. I think in terms of training and how you get to that level of being able to do those sorts of things, I would say go slow, go incremental, and make it a habit, right? I think most runners get injured because they overdo it. They want to go longer, faster. I think it's typically better to increase your frequency, you know, go more often, but keep it fairly short so that your body adjusts and don't overdo it. And then you build on top of that, right? Once you can do a weekly mileage of, let's say, 30 miles, well, make it 40, right, for a couple of months. Then you make it 50, and then you realize, oh, my body is actually able to, you know, cope with that sort of stress. And you get better and better. And I think that's the beauty. You can really build on top of what you've previously achieved. And there isn't really a limit, right? I don't really think, well, there may be, right? There may be some genetics involved, of course, that. But still, I think many people can absolutely go the ultra distance and, you know, go beyond marathon, do a 50K, do a 50 miler and whatnot, or just do really long adventures on their own. If they put in the time and they make it a habit and they're consistently training, right? I don't think there's a magic sort of like limit, right? That certain people can't do that. I think I've seen plenty of examples of folks who never believed they could go that distance, including myself. And if you just hang in and consistently train, right? And yeah, obviously you can't get up every morning and then make a decision. Oh, am I going to run because it's a little cold, it's a little rainy? No, you're just going, right? You're just doing it no matter what. And that's the habit part. I think that is really important.
So Portland, where you're at, comes up all the time in our conversations, our trip planning.
Yeah.
I'm curious, if I'm going to go and do this trip from Mount Adams to Mount St. Helens, there's going to be a part of it where I am resting. Maybe in times beyond COVID, I'll be partying and enjoying myself, having succeeded in this crazy thing that you just did. What are the places to visit in Portland that would that are awesome? What's the best restaurant? What's the best bar?
Oh, that's a hard question now because so many things closed.
Oh, good point.
Gone. But, oh, no. But I think we still beat every other U.S. city in terms of number of breweries. So there's beer everywhere. There's coffee everywhere. I mean, the choices are basically endless. It's really, yeah, I mean, you almost can't go wrong with any of those beer or coffee places. And the food, you know, places as well. There's just anything from food carts up to very high end places. And so it's an amazing place for food, for drinks and for the outdoors. Yeah.
Did you go from Switzerland to Oregon when you took the job, or were you, where are the places that you've lived in between?
No, initially we moved to San Diego. We stayed there for almost 2 years. And then we lived in New Mexico, Santa Fe, for a bunch of years before I moved here. Yeah.
So do you like the desert climate? I mean, I'm gathering from a lot of the Oregon Desert Trail stuff. What was your favorite going through like the subtropical rainforest that is the Pacific Northwest, going through deserts, alpine stuff? What's your favorite of all those?
Well, it's hard to decide. I think I like both really a lot. The desert to me is, you know, it's not something I was used to, right? In Switzerland, you don't have these wide open landscapes where you can see nothing, right? There's always a house or a cow or a fence or something, but the desert is just like so different here, right? I mean, you can drive for hours or you can hike for hours. You see nobody, there's no fence, there's nothing, right? I mean, this is just, it was totally new to me, and experiencing that I think is still fascinating to me. But the lush forests here in Portland or around in the Pacific Northwest, that's another thing I guess we don't have in Switzerland. And I like that equally well. And obviously the mountains and whatnot. So there's a bit of everything. And I think Oregon is really beautiful for that, right? Within an hour's drive from Portland, you can get ocean, you can get mountains, you can get snow, you can get deserts. And right, there's endless choices. Yeah.
Emily, I realize that I've been kind of like leading this right now. I don't know if there's any burning questions in your mind.
You got to most of them, actually. One specific runner nerd question. What are your shoe opinions? What do you run in?
Oh, gosh, I run in a lot of different shoes. I have this belief, which I think I have evidence, at least for myself, that it's not good to run always in the same type of shoe. Mm-hmm. It leads to injuries. you know, just the repetitive sort of like things. If you have the same type of shoe, you always do the same movement. So changing shoes and running in different shoes, and I typically change every day. I change my shoe, not a new shoe, but I have a whole collection, right? I just rotate through them and with a different drop or, you know, different toe box. And it keeps things interesting if I change things, and it doesn't feel like as repetitive. So I like, you know, a wide range of different brands, and I just buy different things and try them out, and some work out, some don't. So I guess that's another recommendation for folks who want to start running, right? Invest in really good shoes and don't wear them out. And maybe buy two different pairs so that you can switch when suddenly you have, like, you know, something starts to hurt. And it may just be because you're using the same shoe and you're always doing the same sort of movement, and a little change may make a big difference.
Was there any other piece of gear that was indispensable to you? I saw that you were wearing a lot of Ultimate Directions or Ultimate Direction stuff. I think that's the name of the brand. Yeah. Is that your preferred for all of your other gear?
Yeah, I have a lot of those, of that gear. La Sportive also is one of my favorite, because they really know how to build mountain shoes and mountain gear and really solid stuff. But again, there's a wide variety of branches, and I just, you know, buy whatever I feel works best for a specific type of adventure. There isn't one brand that does everything well, right? I mean, you got to shop around and...
As a thru-hiker, I'm inclined, at least as a 2016 thru-hiker, I'm inclined to say that Ultra is the solution to all thru-hiking problems. But then again, I know a lot of great shoes have come out since then. So I'm just a nerd on that stuff, I suppose. I have a big question for you. And you said earlier when you get asked the question, what's next, that's a little hard to say because of COVID and because of that. If you had something that you wanted to do as an ultra runner, something that pops into my mind is like the Leadville 100. That's something that's really big on my mind for my lifetime. What's your lifetime goal? What's the thing that you'd love to pin to your name?
I don't think I have that. I mean, I have next goal sort of like, you know, but a year out always seems too far out for me, right? This is like, many things can happen. You know, we've seen that with COVID now, right? You've planned your year and everything was set up, but then things happen. So I'm not looking beyond 2021 at all, but I was signed up for the Iditarod in March, and that got canceled. So that was, you know, one of my big goals. And I worked for many years towards that goal. That's 1,000 miles that you're doing on foot. In Alaska, right, with absolutely brutal temperatures, you have to haul a sled, and it needs very, very careful preparation and a lot of specialized expertise to be successful in that sort of environment. But that's canceled for this year or for next year, and so that was a big bummer.
Yeah. So do you think that you are going to get out within 2021? I guess this is part of the problem, right? In that you can't quite know what the heck's going to be the case in 6 months. Yeah. Are there trails around you right where you live that are really challenging to you, or do you have to go far away to find them?
No, there's plenty of trails, but, you know, this year, for example, the wildfires were a big problem, right? I was going to do a couple of trails in the fall, and everything was closed, you know, from here down to California. Basically, most of the wildernesses were closed because of, you know, huge wildfires. So that, again, was a big problem for many folks here who wanted to do long distance running and, you know, setting FKTs and whatnot on these more time consuming trails. And I assume that's going to be the same next year. So it's really hard to plan, right? I mean, there's just, you know, all these traditional trails like the Arizona Trail and whatnot, but it was basically impossible to do all these trails because there were so many closures.
Right. Well, Christoph, I have one question to finalize. We're the Cleveland Outpost. Our concept is adventure for all. We want to make sure that people that are underserved can get outside in whatever ways they can. What's one way that you'd like to see the outdoors become more inclusive in whatever way to whatever people? What's one way you'd like to see more people get outside?
Well, I think it boils down to encouraging those folks who maybe are not comfortable outside or think they don't have the means to, you know, buy gear and whatnot. I think there's always a way, right? You can borrow things, you can go with people who have more experience. And I think that's, you know, one way I got really into hiking here locally. It's because friends encouraged me to go out, and I wasn't really big into hiking at the beginning when I moved here. And so I would encourage those folks to really, you know, make friends with hikers who have a bit more experience. Maybe they can, you know, lend you some gear and help you to, you know, get the right things set up for you. And also you're becoming part of that community, and you see that that's obviously a very valuable thing. And I think the community aspect is really important for underserved groups.
Well, thank you so much. That's a really good answer, because I think that we have very similar view of what we'd like the outdoors to be. And, you know, if Portland and Cleveland could somehow come closer together, then I'd wave out the window to you and give you a thumbs up, because I really appreciate you having that view. I think that it's really important in the outdoors. Well, Dr. Christoph Tuescher, I really appreciate you coming to speak with us. I know that I can speak for Emily and myself when I say it's an honor. And I think it's really great what you've done in ultra running, man, in the span of 10 years, going from, you know, being just a runner to putting that ultra before. It's got to feel good. It's got to feel good, right? So I really appreciate you coming on. Thank you so much for supporting the Cleveland Outpost. And thank you so much for joining this podcast. One last thing, what's your best pitch to anyone to come visit Portland, Oregon, Mount Adams, and Mount St. Helens? What's the coolest thing they're going to see?
The coolest thing? Gosh, I don't know. People are going to be upset if I say anything.
Well, that's the point.
Well, let's say beer. Beer is
all right.
Beer is really what drives me too.
All right, fair enough. Well, thank you so much, Christoph. I really appreciate it. We will hopefully speak again soon. And thank you for being our guest on Plan That Trip.
That was great fun. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Have you seen the northern lights that shine through every sail? One day Ricky is gonna go, but first he must post his bail. Time is short, so wander past to places you get to see. Snow-capped mountain tops where the streams are clear and the air is clean.
Plan That Trip is a presentation of the Cleveland Outpost's network of podcasts. You can find out more about how we're making the outdoors more accessible for everyone by visiting our website at clevelandoutpost.com. Our theme song is Tune for a Traveler by our good friend Andrew Bonas. Check him out at bonasmusic.com. You can submit your questions or comments, and we would hope that you would, to contact@clevelandoutpost.com. That way, we might just address them in future podcasts. Thanks for listening.